such as Greek or Aramaic. However, as God is made to say in the Quran, "We made it an Arabic Quran so that you can understand." Surah 43, Ayah 3. Compare Surah 12, Ayah 2. And, "We have imparted to you, Muhammad, an Arabic recitation so that you can warn the mother of towns and those who live around it." Surah 42, Ayah 7. Compare Surah 6, Ayah 92. Clearly, the inhabitants of Muhammad's West Arabia were primarily Arabic speakers and participated to some extent in this newly burgeoning Arab identity. For centuries, they had interacted with their northern neighbors in Byzantine Arabia, but very much in a subordinate position. In the 7th century, they would come to play the dominant role and would win the support of many of the inhabitants of Byzantine and Persian Arabia by playing up their shared Arab identity and Arab tongue. The mid-6th century crisis and the unraveling of empire. The rise of these peripheral peoples is likely to be connected, at least in part, with a decline in the fortunes of the empires of Byzantium, Persia, and China in the 5th and 6th centuries, which came to a head in the second half of the 6th century. This means that we should probably consider the Arab conquests as an outcome of this decline rather than its cause. A feeling that matters were going downhill is certainly noted by contemporaries. "There was a time," narrates an eyewitness of the Avar raids around Constantinople in 619, "when things were going well for us and there was no warfare to terrify us, but the summit of prosperity, as they say, was changed through our carelessness and tripped us up, for we were not able to maintain our good fortune untarnished." Little more than a decade later, a Jewish merchant, native of Palestine but on business in Carthage, was to confirm this view. "The territory of the Romans used to extend until our times from the ocean, that is, from Scotia, Britain, Spain, France, Italy, Greece, and Thrace, as far as Antioch, Syria, Persia, and all the East, Egypt, Africa, and the interior of Africa, but now we see Rome humbled." Although politically correct scholars hate to use such value-laden terms as decline, this perception of shrinkage and diminution given by contemporaries does seem borne out by the evidence. A number of minor polities, like Georgia and Ethiopia, which had still been thriving in the early 6th century, seem to splutter and lapse into torpor toward the end of that century. The kingdom of Yemen, ancient Sheba, is so enfeebled that, despite a continuous history going back a millennium and a half, it becomes a puppet state first of Ethiopia, then of Persia. The rest of Arabia is similarly hard hit. The commerce in the Arabian port cities of the Persian Gulf that had boomed in the Hellenistic and Roman period slows to a trickle in the 5th and 6th centuries. In the oases and pilgrimage sites of northwest Arabia, not a single inscription in any language or script is to be found that is dated to the 6th century, despite a rich epigraphic tradition that stretched back more than 1,000 years. Even the rich olive oil-producing lands of northern Syria show a sharp retrenchment in building inscriptions and economic activity in the late 6th century. As far as contemporaries were concerned, there were two key factors responsible for this downturn: recurring bouts of bubonic plague, commencing in 542, by which nearly the whole human race was annihilated, and the increasing frequency and intensity of confrontation between Byzantium and Persia. As a historian writing in 580 put it, "Nations have been wiped out, cities enslaved, populations uprooted and displaced, so that all mankind has been involved in the upheaval." Both phenomena had a major depressing effect upon the population, in turn affecting the economy, which in pre-modern times was very sensitive to demographic fluctuations. It has also been postulated that environmental catastrophe played a part in this mid-6th century recession. Chroniclers from Ireland to China mention crop failures, abnormal cold, and prolonged reduction of sunlight in the year 536 to 537, and this is attributed to ash clouds resulting from volcanic eruptions or meteorites crashing to Earth. A substantial and sustained reduction in harvests would certainly trigger major social unrest further down the road, and one could see this as the ultimate cause of the change and upheaval of the late 6th and early 7th centuries, provoking empires and steppe peoples alike to fight over diminishing resources. Many modern historians are, however, wary of such ideas, in part because they do not understand the science, and in part because they focus principally on human actions rather than environmental factors. Of course, even if disaster hits, humans can still influence their fate by the way they respond to it. One thing for sure, though, is that the choice of the Middle Eastern superpowers to engage in large-scale warfare was the wrong response. Whatever the reason, it is clear that the empires of Byzantium and Persia failed to keep in check the steppe peoples within and beyond their borders in the late 6th and early 7th centuries. The Turks, Avars, and Arabs are all able to make significant encroachments over the course of this period. The same can be said for China, where the Wei dynasty collapsed in 534, and decades of infighting ensued, which was reduced somewhat by the Sui dynasty, 589 to 618, but only properly brought under control with the establishment of the Tang dynasty by Emperor Gaozu, 618 to 626. The Persian Empire suffered the most, since its capital, Seleucia Ctesiphon, was dangerously close to the steppe lands, and the deserts and mountains within its realm favored regional autonomy and limited centralization. Ignominious defeat at the hands of Emperor Heraclius and an ensuing civil war fatally weakened the regime's ability to respond when the Arabs overran their lands. The capitals of the Byzantine and Chinese empires, on the other hand, were far from the steppe and extremely well defended, and the empires themselves, organized around large bodies of water, the Mediterranean Sea and the Yellow and Yangtze rivers, respectively, were reasonably well integrated. This meant that though they also suffered many defeats at the hands of steppe raiders, they were able to weather the storm. The Avars and Turks clearly had ambitions to penetrate further into the lands of Byzantium and Persia, but they were coming from the difficult northern and eastern sides of the two empires, where they faced substantial man-made and natural obstacles, whereas the Arabs were directly adjacent to the soft southern underbellies of these empires, and so it was they who ultimately triumphed in this 7th century great game. Chapter 2. The First Battles, 630 to 640. By the summer of 628, the bitter war between the empires of Byzantium and Persia was finally over. It had begun a full quarter of a century earlier, and in the course of these years, tens of thousands of lives had been lost, the livelihoods of many ruined, and a number of cities sacked. Inevitably, both imperial armies had endured enormous losses, and raiding by various groups, including Arab tribes, was now endemic in marginal areas. Yet, contemporary observers assumed, understandably, that such ancient and powerful states had the resources and organizational capacity to reassert themselves. As the victors, the Byzantines could at least feel encouraged that they enjoyed God's support, and with the advent of peace would be able to repair their defenses and reestablish security. Persia, on the other hand, had suffered a crippling defeat at the hands of Heraclius and the Turks, and many of its local nobles were openly hostile to the ruling family for bringing such shame and ruin upon them and their nation. They murdered Khusro II, who had initiated the ultimately unsuccessful campaign against Byzantium, which ushered in a period of bloodletting and strife. Various candidates fought for control of the state, including a daughter of Khusro II, but most ruled for a very short time and held sway over a limited portion of the realm. Only around 632 to 633 was the succession crisis resolved, when a grandson of Khusro named Yazdgird took charge. In the meantime, the Persian lands had been left critically exposed to potential invaders. Some Arab tribes of northeast Arabia had already begun to test the will of the Persians to defend their southern borders by launching exploratory raids, but a much more potent threat came from Caucasia. A Khagan of the Turks had spotted an opportunity, and in 629 he led out a huge army and spread terror and dread over the face of the earth. He began by ravaging the East Caucasian kingdom of Albania, and then moved westward to Armenia, where he learned that one of Khusro's leading generals was marching against him. This turned out to be the celebrated Shahrbaraz, who had achieved so many victories against the Byzantines in the previous two decades. He picked the head of an Arab cavalry unit and sent him with 10,000 men to trample the Turks beneath the hooves and chests of the horses and scatter them like dust in the wind. But the Turks had prepared an ambush, and while one party of them appeared to flee, causing the Persian contingent to pursue them, another party fell upon the Persians from the rear and sides and massacred them. The Turks now looked set to add Persia to their dazzling list of acquisitions. It was not to be, however, for the cauldron of the north had turned his face against his own sons. A deadly power struggle had broken out at the top. The Khagan himself was killed, and the Turk Confederation imploded. They had squandered their opportunity, and the way was now left open to armies from Arabia. The Arabian Peninsula, Map 2.1. The land of Arabia might at first seem an unlikely home for world conquerors, since huge distances and vast desert expanses had kept it divided into petty kingdoms, ephemeral chiefdoms, and isolated oasis communities for centuries. But this began to change around the year AD 300. The kingdom of Himyar, based in southwest Yemen, managed to subjugate the various principalities around it to become the dominant force in South Arabia. Its leaders made two rather dramatic policy decisions. First, they broke with the past by rejecting the old pagan gods and converting to monotheism. No pagan inscriptions have been discovered that post-date 380, bringing to an abrupt end a 1,300-year-old tradition of polytheism, among the ruling elite at least. Judaism seems to have been the preferred variety of monotheism, though some favored Christianity, especially those with close links to Christian Ethiopia on the other side of the Red Sea. Second, they used the combined resources of their realm to expand northward and succeeded in bringing under their sway many of the Arab tribes of Central and North Arabia. Some they chastened by conquest, as is reported in triumphal terms in a number of royal inscriptions, but many they wooed with subsidies and titles. A 5th-century chief of the tribe of Kinda won just such an accolade for the loyal military support that he gave to Himyar, and he proudly celebrated this honor by having his name etched on a rock in the South Arabian alphabet, together with the title King of Kinda. He and his descendants became so powerful that they attracted the attention of Byzantium and Persia, who vied with each other to draw them over to their side. The ascendancy of the Himyarite monarchy was, however, challenged by the Christian Ethiopian kingdom, which invaded Yemen on the pretext of defending the Christians of that land against the oppression of the ruling clan of the Himyarites, who were mostly Jews. It achieved a resounding victory in this venture, and this ushered in nearly half a century of Ethiopian tutelage over Arabia, circa 525 to 572. Much of this period was dominated by one particular Ethiopian general, named Abraha, circa 535 to 565, who strove to present himself in the manner of a Himyarite king, adopting all the old royal titulature and writing official statements in the local prestige language. He also maintained, and even extended, South Arabian domination over the lands to the north, as is recorded in a number of inscriptions that boast at length about his victories. In the latest text, from the 550s, he tells us that he now controlled towns right across Arabia, including Medina, ancient Yathrib, and had driven the prince of the tribe of Lachem back to his camp at Hira in southwest Iraq. The most famous text, which commemorates the repair of the dam of Marib and the consecration of a church in the same city in 548, suggests that he had genuine political clout, for it records how envoys from Ethiopia, Byzantium, Persia, and three Arab vassal states had arrived to pay their respects. Abraha's kingdom of Arabia did not endure long, however. The sons were not able to sustain their father's triumphs and ruled no more than a few short years. A local Himyarite prince came to power with Persian support, but when he was killed by disgruntled Ethiopians, the Persians decided to impose direct rule. This occurred sometime in the early 570s and heralded the end of the South Arabian civilization that had flourished for more than a millennium and a half. Presumably, the half-century of Ethiopian domination, followed by another half-century of Persian rule, had a deleterious effect on the ancient culture, for though Yemen was a major supplier of troops to the Arab armies, very little of its long tradition of literature and history became a part of the Islamic worldview beyond the haziest of recollections. Not long after the Persians took charge of South Arabia in 582, the Byzantine Emperor Maurice cast off the tribe of Ghassan as an imperial ally and exiled its chief. For a couple of decades, this left the field open to the tribe of Lachem, based in southern Iraq. Its chief endeavored to exert his authority as far afield as West Arabia, and he evidently achieved some success, for East Christian sources describe him as king of all the Arabs in the Persian and Byzantine empires. However, his conversion from paganism to Christianity in 594 made him suspect to his Persian masters, especially when the emperor Khusro sought to launch an all-out war against Byzantium, and so he had the Lachmid chief poisoned and appointed a Persian official to keep the Arabs in check. The Persian Empire now claimed the whole of Arabia, but it is unlikely that they were in full control of anything more than the southwestern tip and the eastern coast, and even this might have been fairly tenuous, given how much of Persia's military resources were tied up with its war against Byzantium. Unfortunately, our contemporary sources offer almost no information at all on Arabia in these crucial decades. Later Muslim writers suggest that in the absence of any political direction from neighboring states, a number of local leaders stepped in to fill the vacuum. Since the usual structures of political authority had broken down, these leaders were not from the ranks of the traditional holders of power. Rather, they claimed authority on religious grounds, arguing that they had been called by God to govern their people. None invoked pagan deities, but presented themselves as monotheist leader prophets, presumably influenced in different ways by the various versions of Christianity and Judaism that were, by this time, fairly well established in Arabia. Not surprisingly, it is one particular leader prophet that we hear most about in later Muslim sources, namely Muhammad, who was based in the central West Arabian settlement of Mecca. He was of little consequence to the outside world until after his death, and so we have no contemporary external sources to elucidate his life, if we are to escape the sacralizing tendencies of later Muslim writers. We are therefore obliged to rely on what we can infer from his religious teachings enshrined in the Quran. These tell us that Muhammad sought to persuade his countrymen to adhere to the pure monotheism that had been established by Abraham, who was, he claimed, their ancestor. He initially attempted to spread his message solely by preaching, but he received a hostile reception from most of his fellow Meccans and had to make a journey in search of refuge, a hijra, ending up in the nearby oasis town of Medina. The time of peaceful preaching was over now, he decided, and it was time to use force to carry out what he perceived to be God's will. He drew up an agreement with a number of groups in Medina to create a single community, Ummah, dedicated to fighting in God's path, jihad fi sabil Allah, that is, in his cause, against his pagan enemies. All who promised to be faithful to the agreement were obligated to contribute to the war effort and to support the other members of the Ummah above anyone else. After founding this polity at Medina in 622, Muhammad launched a number of raids against neighboring tribes and settlements with the aim of recruiting them to his mission. He also kept trying to win over the Meccans, and he finally realized this objective by a mixture of warfare and diplomacy in 628. He sealed the deal by marrying the daughter of Abu Sufyan ibn Harb, who was one of the most powerful men of Muhammad's tribe, namely Quraysh. After cementing the alliance between the Meccans and Medinans, Muhammad went on to bring a third town into their coalition, the fertile oasis of Ta'if, which was dominated by the tribe of Thaqif. This was achieved in 630, and together, the three towns and their allied tribes made a formidable fighting force. It is difficult to be sure what Muhammad's intentions were at this point. Later Muslim authors, and following them, modern historians, assume that he was bent on world domination from the beginning, but it is inherently unlikely that he expected to spread his message so far from the outset. Certainly the Quran suggests that he had more local objectives. God wanted him to warn the mother of towns, assumed to be Mecca, and those who live around it. Surah 42, Ayah 7. Compare Surah 6, Ayah 92. And he gave him an Arabic Quran. Surah 12, Ayah 2, and Surah 43, Ayah 3, in accordance with the general principle that he has only ever sent a messenger with a message in the language of his own people so that he makes it clear for them. Surah 14, Ayah 4. Muhammad's target audience, then, was, initially at least, the Arabic speakers of his own region. He was aware, though, of the wider world. His followers originally prayed facing Jerusalem, and he knew that this was the world's first monotheist sanctuary, and it may be that, having attracted many fighters to his cause, he now aimed to capture this cherished prize. Whether true or not, Muhammad's West Arabian coalition did direct their efforts northward. They had already subjugated the nearby oases of Fadak and Khaybar in 628, but now they went much farther to the north, challenging the Byzantine Empire directly. While Muhammad led this expedition to the north in 630, delegations were sent to other parts of Arabia inviting them to join forces with Muhammad. Medieval Muslim authors, in part wishing to play up the achievements of their prophet, and in part striving to systematize their source material, claimed that these delegations succeeded whether by diplomatic or military means, in winning all of the Arabian Peninsula to Muhammad's rule by the time of his death in June 632, but that subsequently many of its tribes apostatized and seceded and had to be coerced to return to the fold by Muhammad's successor, Abu Bakr. This rebellion of the Arabian tribes, Arabic Ridda, required at least a year, 632 to 633, to quash, they say, and only then could the Arab conquests, Arabic Futuh, commence in the 12th year of Muhammad's community, 633 to 634. One could imagine that the tribes of Southwest Arabia had begun to join the new movement already in Muhammad's lifetime, especially when they saw how successful it was. But East Arabia is separated from the West by vast, inhospitable deserts, including the aptly named Empty Quarter, and in any case, as we shall see further on, its tribes were already launching their own raids against Persia. It is more likely, then, that not that much of Arabia outside the western flank had been brought under the control of Muhammad's forces by the time of his death. Abu Bakr's task, therefore, was not to reconquer Arabia, but simply to conquer it, or at least to win it over to the movement's cause. Possibly he did not fully accomplish even this, for according to a contemporary Armenian chronicle, only after the Arabs had invaded Syria and Iraq did they then penetrate with royal armies into the original borders of the territory of Ishmael. Byzantine Arabia, Palestine, and Syria. Map 2.2. Muhammad's campaign northward into the Byzantine province of Arabia in 630 was apparently planned in response to intelligence about military preparations against his coalition by some neighboring pro-Byzantine Arab tribes. Khalid ibn al-Walid, a tough, no-nonsense soldier, led a detachment northwest to Dumat al-Jandal, an important stop on a desert trade route from southern Syria to northern Arabia, while Muhammad himself commanded the main body of men and marched directly northward. He passed by Meda'in Salih, the southern capital of the ancient Nabataean kingdom, and reached Tabuk, an oasis in the far northwest of modern Saudi Arabia. There is no natural border between the Arabian Peninsula and the lands to the north of it. Crossing from modern Saudi Arabia to Jordan, one observes no change in the scenery. The same imposing sandstone mountains, volcanic outcrops, and bleak, sandy desert continue for a while as one heads northward. It was quite natural, then, that Muhammad, encountering no resistance at Tabuk, should continue on another 125 miles to Ayla, modern Aqaba, the northernmost port of the Red Sea, and on another 65 miles to Udruh, very near Petra, the main capital of the Nabataean kingdom. This was, in any case, the route that traders between West Arabia and southern Syria had been used to taking for many centuries now. The terms of the peace agreements Muhammad concluded with these and neighboring settlements differ considerably, suggesting that there was no collective negotiation by an agent of the Byzantine government, but rather the towns had been left to fend for themselves, and the head persons of each place had to bargain as best they could. Presumably, the Persians, who had nominally occupied this region during the years 614 to 628, had been too busy establishing their hold over cities and extending their conquests of Byzantine lands to worry about the security of outlying areas. In such a situation, it is not surprising, as contemporary evidence makes clear, that Muhammad's followers had precursors. One chronicle records that in 610, a band of Arabs came out of Arabia into the regions of Syria. They pillaged and laid waste many lands, committed many massacres of men, and burned without compassion or pity. A monk of Mar Saba Monastery in the Judean desert, tells us that 2 months after the sack of Jerusalem by the Persians in 614, the monks were still unwilling to return to their monasteries in the desert for fear of the Saracens. And a monk from a monastery near Jericho describes the depredations of bands of Hebrews and Saracens. The situation was not immediately improved when the Byzantines took back control of this region, for as one paymaster told a group of Arabs who came to claim their subsidies for keeping the desert roads safe, "The emperor can barely pay his soldiers their wages, much less you dogs." Before we get into the accounts of the battles themselves, it is worth making clear that we have no good descriptions of the tactics or weaponry employed by any of the parties involved. As we said in the last chapter, the genre of Greco-Roman classicizing history, which had treated politics and warfare and was written by those who had experience in these matters, had passed away. The men who subsequently chronicled military affairs were mostly clergymen on the Christian side and storytellers and religious scholars of different sorts on the Muslim side. Their purpose in writing was to show the workings of God, not the machinations of man. Storytellers, or we might say preachers, had served in Arab armies from an early stage, encouraging the troops by recalling past glories and heroic exploits, so adding a human dimension to the bare facts. They give us an impression, for example, of the characters of the early warriors, Abu Ubaidah as prudent, Khalid ibn al-Walid as impetuous, Amr ibn al-As as wily, and of the self-image of the conquerors, soldiers by day and monks by night, emphasizing their passion for jihad and zuhud, simple living. We almost never receive from any writer, however, reliable details about troop strength and movements, specific planning, weapons deployed, layout of the site, and so on. In particular, the numbers given by our sources are very erratic, and the reader must just bear in mind that provisioning large numbers of soldiers was very difficult in the time before mechanized agriculture and transport. An army of 5,000 to 10,000 men is already very substantial, and 30,000 to 40,000 near the limit of what it is possible to sustain, especially in less fertile areas. The first sure contemporary information that we get about the movements of the West Arabian armies comes from a chronicle that would seem, from the precision of its report, to depend on a local source. It tells us that in the year 945 of the Greeks, A.D. 634, on Friday, 4 February, at the ninth hour, a Byzantine force engaged the Arabs of Muhammad in Palestine, 12 miles east of Gaza. Nothing is said about the course of the confrontation, but it is simply noted that the Byzantines fled, leaving behind their patrician, whom the Arabs killed, and that some 4,000 poor villagers of Palestine were killed there, Christians, Jews, and Samaritans, and the Arabs ravaged the whole region. This would appear to correspond to an equally brief notice in Muslim sources about a battle in the spring of 634 at Dathin, described as one of the villages of Gaza, in which a general was killed. As the banditry continued, the governor of Palestine, based in the regional capital of Caesarea, felt that he should take action, for the Arabs were now entering the agricultural areas and nearing major settlements. He marched south toward Beit Jabrin, which bore the grand name of Eleutheropolis, that is, Freedom City. However, the Arabs had prepared an ambush for him and at an opportune moment leaped out of their hiding places, screaming and shouting, and fell upon a unit of Samaritans, who, unfortunately for them, were at the front and faced the full brunt of the Arab onslaught. They buckled under the force of the attack, and every one of them perished by the sword. Seeing this, the commander retreated, precipitating the hasty and disorderly flight of his men. The chronicler of this rout, though he had no Byzantine victory to boast of, managed to give a positive twist to his account by lauding the bravery of the governor, who, having fallen off his horse in the path of the pursuing Arabs, waves away his attendants, bidding them to save themselves, lest you and I shall drink the cup of death together. This confrontation is probably to be equated with what Muslim sources call the Battle of Ajnadain, which took place in July 634, since it too involved the death of a high-ranking Byzantine official. Another encounter occurred in the vicinity of Rabath Moab, to the east of the southern stretch of the Dead Sea. Here, the austere and barren mountain range that accompanies the traveler from Arabia gives way to the more gentle and fertile highland region of the northern Jordan Valley. Rabath, renamed Areopolis by the Romans, is situated at the point of this transition and lies on the ancient road known as the King's Highway, linking the cities of Ayla and Amman. The remains of a pagan temple are still visible today, but in Muhammad's time, Rabath was a major Christian center, important enough to have its own bishop attend the Council of Ephesus in AD 449. Here, then, the Arabs might have expected stiff resistance, but again they caught their opponents unawares. A contemporary source says that a Byzantine force was encamped in the vicinity, and that the Arabs, falling on them unexpectedly, put them to the sword and put to flight Theodore, brother of the Emperor Heraclius. One might wonder that such a senior figure in the Byzantine establishment would be involved. Perhaps there is confusion with an assistant of the provincial governor, Vicarius, of the same name, that is, Theodore, who was also fighting the Arabs in this region. However, numerous sources, Muslim ones included, do agree that Heraclius's brother was involved in an early confrontation with the Arabs, and that, chastened by his defeat, he hurried back to Constantinople. The Arabs pressed on, and taking the desert route in order to avoid major centers of settlement, they arrived at Bostra by the autumn of 634, in the south of modern Syria, just across the border from Jordan. It was a rich and prosperous city, the capital of the Byzantine province of Arabia. Situated in a large, fertile plain, it served as an important market for pastoralists coming to sell their animal products and to buy grain, oil, wine, and manufactured goods. To the northeast rose the volcanic hills of the Hauran, in which all sorts of fruits were grown, including the grapes that provided the wine extolled in pre-Islamic Arabic poems. Christian and Muslim chroniclers are agreed that the capture of Bostra was a brief affair, for the city simply surrendered to the Arabs on the agreement that its residents' lives and property would be safeguarded in return for payment of tribute. In the 6th century, there would have been a military commander based at Bostra, responsible for the troops stationed in the province of Arabia and for the overall security of that province. But it is possible that after the Persian occupation, military resources were concentrated in Damascus, only 60 or so miles to the north, or at least that a new commander for Bostra was not yet in place, which would explain why the city appears not to have put up any resistance. Contemporary chroniclers record very few clashes between Arab and Byzantine armies in this region, but other types of sources suggest that acts of despoliation and looting were common. On the other side of the River Jordan, in Jerusalem, the newly elected patriarch Sophronius, a former monk with a passion for Greek learning and rhetoric, had strong feelings about the invaders. In the letter he wrote to mark his elevation to the headship of the Palestinian church in 634, he rails against the Saracens, who, on account of our sins, have now risen up against us unexpectedly and ravage all with cruel and feral design, with impious and godless audacity. Later in the year, The security situation was so bad that he could not travel to Bethlehem and was obliged to give his nativity sermon in Jerusalem. As happened to the Israelites at the hands of the Philistines, he laments. So now the army of the godless Saracens has captured the divine Bethlehem and bars our passage there, threatening slaughter and destruction. The patriarch's last and most detailed description of the Arab attacks appears in his sermon on the holy baptism, which he delivered on the Feast of the Epiphany, December 6th of either 635 or 636. He urges his congregation to eschew sin, for this is the reason why the vengeful and God-hating Saracens, the abomination of desolation clearly foretold to us by the prophets, overrun the places which are not allowed to them, plunder cities, devastate fields, burn down villages, set on fire the holy churches, overturn the sacred monasteries, and oppose the Byzantine armies arrayed against them. Of course, one cannot take such accusations at face value, since Sophronius is indulging in high rhetoric to ram home his message of repentance and abstinence from wrongdoing, but the threat was evidently real enough to make his sermon convincing. Chroniclers now focus on an encounter that, in retrospect, was viewed as turning the tide against Byzantium and in favor of the Arabs, the Battle of Yarmouk. The name refers to the river that flows westward along the modern border between Jordan and Syria and empties into the River Jordan, just south of the Sea of Galilee. The Arabs were led by two of their most famous generals, the aforementioned Khalid ibn al-Walid and Abu Ubaidah ibn al-Jarrah, who comes across as a tough but fair and pragmatic man. Both were from the Prophet's tribe of Quraysh, but whereas the former was from a clan that long opposed Muhammad, Abu Ubaidah had been a close companion of the Prophet from the very start of his mission. The Emperor Heraclius had traveled to northern Syria to obtain better intelligence about events and realized that matters were serious, and so he appointed his top general in the east, the Armenian Vahan, to take charge of the operation. Heraclius was particularly worried that the key city of Damascus was under threat, and so he dispatched messengers to instruct legions with spare capacity to release some troops for the defense of the Syrian capital. Vahan marched from Antioch with the main army, apparently routing a small Arab exploratory force on the way, in the vicinity of Homs. In the early summer of 636, an enormous multitude of Saracens set out from Arabia and headed for the region of Damascus. Presumably, the success of the initial Arab raids had encouraged many others to join the venture. Worried by this, Vahan wrote to Theodore, a patrician of Edessa and a senior financial administrator, to bring reinforcements, and he arrived with a further 10,000 men. Once all were assembled, they encamped together, right by the bank of the river Yarmouk. The Byzantine force looked very strong, but fortune was not on their side. An initial encounter in July 636 resulted in a defeat for the contingent of Theodore. This led to an argument between the latter and the Armenians, who subsequently proclaimed their own general emperor while abjuring Heraclius. Theodore's men withdrew, and the Arabs seized the moment to attack. Some had been hidden in ambush around the Byzantine camp, and they now jumped out and fell upon the enemy. The Byzantines attempted to flee, but the dense mud of the floodplain bogged them down, and the heat of the sun overwhelmed them. Many thousands were either cut down by the sword or slipped down the steep sides of the river valley and were either crushed or drowned. The exact details of the battle are difficult to recover, but the loss of Byzantine life was evidently considerable, for it sent shockwaves around the empire, even as far away as Gaul, where one Frankish chronicler spread news of the calamity. The latter, and another Latin source, blame at least some of the loss of Byzantine life on an outbreak of the plague, which was raging in Syria at that time. Heraclius realized that it would be a while before more troops could be mustered, and so he issued orders to all the provinces to the effect that no one should try to engage the Arabs in open combat, but everyone should instead try to maintain their positions as best they could. He himself returned to Constantinople, and is prematurely portrayed by later Christian and Muslim authors as bidding Syria a sorrowful farewell, saying, "Sosu Syria," which means, "Rest in peace, Syria," as if he despaired of ever seeing her again. This victory allowed the Arabs, as one writer put it, to take firm possession of the provinces which they had not long since invaded, and locate their rule at Damascus, the most splendid city of Syria. From this firm base, the Arabs were able to extend their conquests to the rest of the Levant. Christian sources speak most about three key cities: Homs, ancient Emesa, and the resting place of the head of St. John the Baptist; Jerusalem, the seat of a patriarch and numerous churches and monasteries; and Caesarea, the capital of Palestine and an important port. The capture of Homs gives us an insight into why many cities seem to fall with such apparent ease to the Arabs. It had tried to hold out against a siege during the winter of 636 to 637, hoping that the cold would make the Arabs give up, and that Heraclius would be able to raise an army to relieve them. But as the winter wore on, disputes broke out, some arguing that it would be better to surrender now when they could negotiate reasonable terms, others countering, "How can we do that when the emperor is still in authority and power?" Finally, as it became clear that help was not forthcoming, the inhabitants sued for peace, and they received, like Damascus, a written covenant guaranteeing them security for their lives, possessions, churches, and laws, in return for payment of 110,000 gold coins as the tribute of the city. The relative fairness of the conditions of surrender encouraged many cities to submit rather than face a grueling blockade and possible slaughter, especially as they had already endured the hardship of the Persian invasion and occupation just a few years beforehand. Moreover, those cities adjacent to the Syrian desert, and that included all the settlements that submitted early on, like Bostra, Damascus, Homs, Amman, and Hama, were accustomed to dealing with Arab tribes and had relations with them on a number of different levels. They were also home to a moderate population of well-to-do and well-educated Christian Arabs, such as the Mansur family, who served as financial administrators for Heraclius in Damascus, and continued to do so for the Arabs well into the 8th century. As for Jerusalem, the accounts of its capture are, as one might expect of this holiest of cities, charged with religious overtones, but they are annoyingly bereft of concrete detail. A late Christian source makes a brief reference to a 2-year siege, but gives no details or clarification. Our only contemporary source reports that the Lord's cross and all the vessels of the churches of God were taken away by sea to Constantinople for safekeeping, but of military matters simply says that having requested an oath from the Arabs that they would respect life and property, the people of Jerusalem submitted to the Arabs. Otherwise, Christian writers focus on two particular events. First, there is the building of a mosque on the site of the former Jewish temple, which is related by a number of contemporary and near-contemporary authors, and so there is no reason to doubt it. We even have a description of it from a Gallic pilgrim who subsequently traveled to Iona in Scotland and recounted his travels to its abbot in the 670s. He tells him that he recalls seeing in the place where Herod's temple once stood, near the eastern wall, a rectangular house of prayer, which the Arabs had constructed over some ruined remains. It was evidently a sizable building, for it could accommodate, he says, at least 3,000 people. Second, there is the visit of the Caliph Umar I, 634 to 644, to the Holy City. This event is not reported by any early source, and appears first only in a mid-8th century chronicle, which concentrates on the meeting between Umar and the patriarch Sophronius. Umar was allegedly dressed in filthy garments of camel hair, and the patriarch, seeing this, offered him a clean loincloth and overgarment, but Umar refused, only accepting in the end. After Sophronius's insistence, to wear the clean clothes for a short time until his own had been washed. There are a number of occasions in the Bible when clothes are washed or exchanged as part of a ritual of purification or investiture, such as when the high priest Joshua arrived before the angel of the Lord in dirty attire and is given new, priestly robes in their stead. Zechariah chapter 3, verses 1 through 5. But the exact message of the chronicler is unclear. In Muslim accounts of Umar's trip to Jerusalem, he is also wearing rough dress, but that is part of his image as a humble and simple man who is wary of the trappings of civilization. Here it is Muslims urging Umar to put on smart clothes so that he will not appear lowly to the non-Muslims, and Umar's refusal to do so is intended as a criticism of Muslims who covet fine attire after the fashion of the Byzantines and Persians, and are seduced by earthly concerns. Caesarea, like all the Mediterranean coastal settlements, was much less acquainted with the Arabs than were the inland cities that bordered the Syrian desert. Its residents were more likely to be of the same doctrinal persuasion as Constantinople and the emperor, namely Chalcedonian, accepting the creed agreed upon at the Council of Chalcedon in AD 451, and more likely to speak the same language, Greek, rather than Aramaic or Arabic. Moreover, as the provincial capital, it had more to prove, had more to protect, and had a legion based in the city, and so would, of course, be expected to put up a fight. The new commander of the Arab forces in Syria, Muawiyah ibn Abi Sufyan, recognized this challenge and so brought 72 siege engines, which hurled stones day and night. This went on from December 640 to May 641, until finally the massive encircling walls of the city were breached. Since the troops had obdurately refused to surrender, Muawiyah decided to make an example of them, and all the 7,000 stationed there were killed, save those who had managed to escape by boat to Asia Minor. The city was not razed, but its strongly pro-imperial ethos and the ease with which it could be supplied by sea from Constantinople meant that it was not deemed suitable by the Arabs as an administrative base. They preferred the inland cities with their closer access to the desert and their greater familiarity with Arabic and Arab tribes. Consequently, whereas many of the coastal cities declined after the Arab conquests, early Islamic Caesarea is only one-tenth the size of late antique Caesarea, the inland cities, Damascus, Bostra, Jerash, Pella, Jerusalem, and so on, all enjoyed a considerable measure of growth. Iraq, Map 2.3. After Khusro II's murder of the chief of the tribe of Lahm and its loss of imperial support, all the Arabs of the Byzantine and Persian realms revolted and dispersed, each group acting according to his own will, observed one chronicler, and they became powerful and caused much trouble in the provinces. For example, at Dhu Qar, near Kufa, around the year 610, tribal groups loyal to the Lahmids confronted and defeated other tribes that were allies of the Persians. It was probably a very minor encounter, and only involved Arab factions, but it was later celebrated as the first victory of the Arabs over the Persians. Matters worsened when civil war broke out after the death of Khusro II in 628, and reached a nadir in June 630 when the Empress Boron came to the throne. Among the neighboring Arabs, the word went around that the Persians no longer have a king. They have sought refuge in a woman, and many took to pillaging the frontier lands of the empire. Some men from northeast Arabian tribes went and joined those who were massing on the borders of Persia and started raiding the local nobles, seizing whatever they could. Later Muslim historians maintain that Abu Bakr participated in the planning of these attacks, but this is clearly a retrospective attempt to bring all fighting against the empires under the banner of Muhammad's community. They also wanted to provide a neat chronological schema. The mutiny of the tribes of Arabia in year 11 of the community, 632 to 633, had first to be suppressed before the conquests could be initiated in year 12, 633 to 634. However, since these historians also mention that Persian rulers of the period 628 to 632 were on the throne at the time of these raids, it is evident that, as was the case with the Levant, the various tribes living on the imperial frontiers had already begun to take advantage of the empire's weakness to plunder the outlying areas long before Muhammad's West Arabian coalition became involved. The early clashes were principally between Arab tribes of different affiliations, and only local Persian officials were involved. At the oasis town of Ain at-Tamr in southwest Iraq, for instance, a Persian garrison, backed up by a division of Arab recruits levied from the tribes of Namr, Taghlib, and Iyad, opposed the general dispatched by Abu Bakr, namely Khalid ibn al-Walid. However, as the raids snowballed, the matter came to the notice of the regime's leaders and of contemporary chroniclers. We are lucky that an Armenian historian writing shortly after 660, referred to by modern scholars as Sebeios, took an interest and gave an account which, supplemented by a couple of other writers, allows us to get a reasonable picture of the march of events. As happened in Syria, the success of minor skirmishes in the late 620s and early 630s paved the way for a large-scale invasion in 636, involving considerable numbers of tribesmen from the Arabian Peninsula. The invaders marched from central Arabia through the endless, flat, stony wastes of northeast Arabia until eventually reaching the beginning of the fertile alluvial lands of lower Iraq. Meeting little resistance, they pushed on in the direction of the Persian capital, Seleucia Ctesiphon. This was a huge, sprawling settlement established on both sides of the River Tigris, some 20 miles south of modern Baghdad, and comprising numerous palaces built in the course of the many centuries of the city's life. The Arabs laid siege to it through the winter of 636 to 637, but in the meantime, Rustam, the prince of Media, northwest Iran, had assembled a huge army, including contingents from Armenia, Albania, modern North Azerbaijan, and Siunik, modern South Armenia. Such was the size and might of the army that Rustam, so it was said, haughtily expected to trample all the southerners underfoot. The emperor Yazdgird participated too, rallying the troops with encouraging words and distributing stipends. In the autumn of 637, the Persian army got underway. They crossed the River Tigris and slowly and inexorably drove the Arabs back, defeating them in the odd pitched battle. One is recorded in Muslim sources under the name of the Battle of the Bridge, until eventually they forced them right back to their own borders, to the west bank of the Euphrates. Both sides then encamped there by the village of Qadash, Arabic Qadisiyya, a short distance to the south of Hira. In an initial encounter, the Arabs were worsted, but a few days later they received reinforcements from Arabia of a multitude of cavalry and 20,000 infantry, and thus heartened, they sped forward, covered with shields, eager to fight against the Persian troops. This seemed to throw the Persian army into confusion, and many fled. A general rout ensued, and many of the nobles were killed, including the princes of Armenia, Siunik, and Media. Some, such as Juanshir, king of Albania, only escaped by hurling themselves headlong into the river Euphrates and swimming for their lives to the opposite bank. The engagement, referred to as the Battle of Qadisiyya in Muslim sources, took place on January 6, 638, and, like the Battle of Yarmouk in the Levant, was retrospectively perceived as a turning point in the Arab conquest of the Persian Empire. It brought great fame to the key Arab general, Sa'd ibn Abi Waqqas, of the tribe of Quraysh, and it also brought immortality to Rustum, who is celebrated in the Persian national epic as a valiant but tragic hero, the last great noble knight of the Persian Empire, sorrowfully predicting that after him, lineage and honor will count for naught. Having gained the upper hand, the Arabs now went back on the offensive. In the course of 638, they established control over lower Iraq, and so, one chronicler informs us, they began to collect the taxes. This allowed them to keep their men fully fed and equipped, and after subduing the area around Seleucia Ctesiphon, they renewed their siege of the capital itself, maintaining their position for at least 6 months. Seeing that the situation in the capital was hopeless, Emperor Yazdgird arranged for the new general of the army of Media, Khurazad, who was the brother of Rustum, to effect an evacuation operation. The plan was to get the emperor out of Seleucia Ctesiphon to the comparative safety of a royal estate some 70 miles to the northeast. With much haste, the contents of the treasury were packed up, and the inhabitants of the capital assembled, and Khurazad and his men led out the procession in the direction of their new home. On the way, however, they were unexpectedly attacked by a contingent of Arabs that had managed to make it across the river Tigris. A short battle ensued, probably that known as the Battle of Jalula in the Muslim sources, but the Persian troops, jittery after their dismal defeat at Qadash, quickly gave up the fight and fled, obliging Yazdgird to take to his heels along with them. The Arabs appropriated the forsaken wealth and returned with it to the newly captured Seleucia Ctesiphon. Yazdgird and his retinue hurried on to seek refuge in the Zagros mountain range, which protected Iran from any army marching from the plains of Babylonia and Mesopotamia, and stopped off on the way at the ancient city of Hulwan. In the course of the year 640, he was continually on the move, seeking a place where he could obtain a breathing space and the time to rally an army. He descended from the mountains, traveling southeast to Isfahan, and then southward to Istakhr, the capital of Fars, which was the heartland and homeland of the Sasanian dynasty, where he knew he could count on the support of the local army. The Jazira, Northern Mesopotamia, Map 2.2. The clashes narrated so far all happened in the southern parts of the Levant and Iraq and quite close to the Syrian desert. By contrast, contemporary observers report no battles occurring in the northern parts of these regions. This is possibly because settlements there all submitted to the Arabs without a fight. They had already suffered badly in the earlier Byzantine-Persian War of 603 to 628, and so would have been discouraged from making a stand, especially when news came in of the recent Arab successes in the south. The only other theater of war that we hear of is the Jazira. This term means island in Arabic, and it refers to the territory that is virtually encircled by the northern arms of the mighty Euphrates and Tigris rivers, comprising parts of modern northwest Iraq, northeast Syria, and southeast Turkey. It was the heartland of Aramaic Christianity, as indeed it still is today, though there are dramatically fewer Christians there now. The whole land of the Jazira, wrote one local resident, was rich in vineyards, fields, and much cattle. There was not one single poor and miserable man in any village who did not possess a plow, donkey, and goats. There were also large areas of steppe well suited to grazing, and these were the preserve of a number of powerful Arab pastoralist tribes. The territory's wealth meant that it was attractive to great powers and indeed was fought over by Byzantium and Persia for many centuries before becoming a border zone between the Byzantine and Arab states. The Arab commander in Syria, Abu Ubaidah, entrusted his kinsman Iyad ibn Ghannam, a man famed for his generosity, to oversee the subjugation of the cities of northern Syria. In 638, while Iyad was at the encampment of Kinasrin, near the great Hellenistic city of Chalcis and just south of modern Aleppo, the governor of Byzantine Mesopotamia, John Cattaeus, came to meet him. His mission was to save his province from Arab occupation, but he did not have sufficient troops to achieve this aim by military means. Instead, he promised to pay Iyad every year 100,000 gold coins, on condition that he would not cross